This program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the May 1st, 2026 online edition of the New Yorker. It's possible to learn in our sleep. Should we? New research suggests that people can communicate and even practice skills while dreaming, by Shayla Love. In 1932, the inventor Alois Benjamin Salinger patented the psychophone, a phonograph hooked up to a timer which could play recordings while a person was asleep. The audio could be heard at his dimly lit office on Lafayette Street in Lower Manhattan. In one recording, titled Prosperity, Salinger intoned, "I have complete confidence in the psychophone. It lulls me to sleep. But my unconscious mind hears and is deeply impressed by these affirmations. Money wants me and comes to me." In another titled Mating, he declared, "I radiate love. I have a fascinating and attractive personality. My conversation is interesting. My company is delightful. I have a strong sex appeal." An advertisement in Psychology magazine declared that by listening to Salinger's messages overnight, a person could get results that, quote, would take months or years to accomplish by conscious effort, end quote. The device cost up to $235, more than $4,000 in today's money. In 1933, a writer for this magazine visited Salinger and reviewed letters from satisfied customers. Some said that they had lost weight or come into money. One claimed to be expecting a psychophone baby. People have long fantasized about learning effortlessly during sleep. What if you could snooze through War and Peace or a Mandarin course and wake up having absorbed it? In Aldous Huxley's dystopian novel Brave New World, hypnopedia, sleep education, not only teaches new languages, but brainwashes people with government messaging. Many thinkers have reported that key insights came to them in their dreams. For the Russian chemist Dmitry Mendeleev, in 1869, it was the organization of the elements into the periodic table. For the novelist Mary Shelley, it was the plot of Frankenstein. When scientists initially studied attempts to learn while sleeping, the results seemed promising. In a 1916 study, Navy soldiers seemed to better learn Morse code when it was played overnight. In 1942, a researcher tried to get 20 boys at a summer camp to stop biting their nails. 300 times a night, for almost 2 months, he played the phrase, "My fingernails taste terribly bitter," through a loudspeaker. 40% of them stopped biting their nails, and none in a control group did. Participants in a 1952 experiment memorized more Chinese words when they heard vocabulary while asleep. But these early studies were deeply flawed, most significantly because they couldn't verify that test subjects were actually unconscious. Brain scans were not widely available, and there was scant knowledge of sleep stages, such as REM sleep, when more vivid dreams take place. In a 1954 paper, the researchers Charles W. Simon and William H. Emmons concluded that in most sleep learning studies, subjects were actually awake, rendering their findings essentially meaningless. The nail-biting boys may have stopped biting because they heard negative messaging, not because they had learned unconsciously. Ken Poller, a sleep researcher and a cognitive neuroscientist at Northwestern University, told me that Simon and Emmons effectively condemned sleep learning to the realm of science fiction and quackery. "People didn't study it much for decades," he said. "It was thought to be a crock." In recent years, though, scientists have been trying again. Last year, Karen Conkoly, a dream researcher who was then a postdoc student in Poller's laboratory, gave puzzles to a group of lucid dreamers, people who, during dreams, often become aware that they are dreaming. Dashiell Bark-Huss, a 35-year-old software programmer who lives in Chicago, remembered being stumped by one of the puzzles. How do you plant four trees that are all exactly the same distance from each other? You obviously can't plant them in a straight line. You can't arrange them in a square either. Trees along the sides will be closer than those diagonally across from each other. Konkoli, who is herself a lucid dreamer, told study participants to try working on a puzzle while asleep that night. Bark Huss spent the night in Pollard's laboratory with electrodes on her head. She told me that not all of her dreams that evening were lucid, yet a scene in one of them faintly echoed the tree puzzle. She dreamed that she and her sister were floating on balloons of some sort, and poles were rising up from each one. This seemed to mirror the solution to the puzzle. One of the trees must be lifted up and planted on a hill so that their four locations form a pyramid. I solved the puzzle the next day, Bark Huss told me. The current wave of sleep learning research began in 2007 after a team led by Bjorn Rasch, a Swiss cognitive biopsychologist who researches sleep, administered a clever experiment. The team asked people to memorize locations on a graph while smelling the scent of rose. Later, when the participants were sleeping, they were exposed to the scent again. The next day, no one remembered smelling the rose overnight, yet unconscious exposure seemed to help them remember the locations better. Pollard tried a similar experiment in 2009, this time using sound. Participants learned the locations of 50 objects. Each was associated with a distinct noise. When Pollard played a subset of the noises to sleeping participants, monitoring their brainwaves to confirm that they were actually asleep, no one remembered hearing the sounds. But afterward, they could better recall where the corresponding objects were. This approach is now known as targeted memory reactivation. What we learn in our sleep can apparently influence our behavior, too. In 2014, the neuroscientist Anat Arzi was a graduate student at the Weizmann Institute of Science. She published a study that exposed sleeping participants to pairings of scents. Smokers, who smelled a mix of cigarettes and rotting fish overnight, subsequently reduced their cigarette consumption by more than 30%, more than people who smelled the pairing while awake. Rasch and Arzi's most significant findings were from sleep stages in which people dream less frequently. Emma Peters, a self-described dream engineer at the University of Bern, has instead conducted experiments on lucid dreamers while they are in REM sleep. In these kinds of experiments, participants are told to practice physical activities, finger tapping, coin tossing, dart throwing with a non-dominant hand, within their dreams. After they wake up, they turn out to show more improvement on those tasks than a control group. That said, dreams are not the most controlled experiment. One dart-throwing dreamer was distracted by a volley of darts from a doll that suddenly appeared. This participant was not any better at throwing darts the next day. In perhaps the most striking example of learning during sleep, Konkoli, Pollard, and several collaborators witnessed what amounted to conversations with people who were in the midst of dreams. Independent lab groups in the U.S., France, Germany, and the Netherlands asked lucid dreamers to answer yes or no questions and solve simple math problems. Electrodes measuring body and brain activity verified that the participants were not awake. Martin Dressler, a sleep researcher at the Donders Institute, who ran the Dutch experiments, said that they were able to verbally deliver new information to the sleeping mind and to receive responses. Some people could remember the questions they had been asked when they woke up. This is a form of very complex learning, he told me. Christopher Mazurek, one of the participants in the study, was 19 at the time. He recalled hearing a math problem, 8 minus 6, during a lucid dream. He doesn't remember what the dream was about, something about my favorite video game, he told me. But he knew that the question came from beyond the dream. He was instructed to respond by moving his eyes from left to right. And sure enough, the researchers counted two rightward movements of his eyes. Other participants experienced the sounds within the context of their dreams. In one, the question seemed to emanate from a dream radio. Thomas Andrion, a sleep neuroscientist at the Paris Brain Institute, who was not involved in the research, called it one of the most mind-breaking papers I've ever read. Once, in Pollard's lab, Bark Huss dreamed that she crashed her car. She was convinced that she had spent too much time as a study participant and had become sleep-deprived. She saw flashing lights that she interpreted as the police. "I was freaking out because I thought I might have killed somebody," she told me. "Then I realized it's not the cops. I'm in the lab now, and that's the light from the lab." She was able to communicate with Konkoli using eye signals, and through it all, she continued sleeping. She remembered finding it eerie to come across signals from the waking world. "You realize that somebody is communicating to you from what feels like another dimension," she said. Konkoli's study of problem solving was published earlier this year in Neuroscience of Consciousness. 20 lucid dreamers, including Bark Huss, spent multiple nights in the lab trying to work out puzzles in their sleep. Each puzzle was paired with a specific sound, which was supposed to prompt them to resume work on the associated puzzle. One participant dreamed of asking for help from a fellow passenger in a car. "I actually don't know," the passenger replied. "It's kind of hard." Another dreamed of solving the puzzle when it appeared on a school exam. Upon waking, the solution was apparent in real life. In the lab, participants figured out 42% of the puzzles that showed up in their dreams. They solved only 17% of the ones that didn't. Most people are not lucid dreamers, so the people Pollard and Konkoli studied were not representative of the general population. But, curiously, participants had the highest solve rate when the puzzles appeared in ordinary dreams, not lucid ones. Sleep stages differ in important ways, Monica Schunauer, a sleep researcher at the University of Freiburg, who wasn't involved in the study, told me. "Maybe the stage in which lucid dreams occur doesn't involve as many creative leaps." She called the research crazy, adding, "I mean this in the best possible way. It's super impressive." So is it time to design a new psychophone, one that might actually work? "Certain kinds of thinking might be easier while we are asleep," Pollard said. "To solve the tree puzzle," he pointed out, "you have to think in another dimension, in three dimensions instead of two, when you're planting the trees. That might be something our unconscious mind is better at. When we are asleep, we might be more ready to associate unrelated stimuli," Andrion said. "This could explain why the scent of cigarette smoke and rotting fish had an impact on people who were snoozing, but not on people who were awake. But there could be many downsides to interfering with an activity as essential and mysterious as sleep. We depend on sleep for restoring the body and mind. It's believed not only to consolidate important memories, but also to discard those that can be forgotten. Sleep has its own universe, and we should better use that moment for what it's good for," Andrion said. In a recent paper, Pollard and others showed that targeted memory reactivation can disrupt sleep, which undermines the learning that is supposed to take place in the process. Andrion warned against trying to harness the sleeping mind in the surface of the waking world. "Dreams are not some barren landscape waiting to be populated," he said. "They follow their own rules and presumably serve their own inexplicable aims. We should care about them, promote them, and nurture them, rather than trying to replace them," Andrion said. On this point, Konkoli, who is now a postdoctoral fellow at Cambridge University, agrees. Not long ago, at a sleep conference, she discussed the dangers of trying to colonize sleep with what she called wake-centric values. In her own life, she might prefer to learn from sleep than learn during sleep. In a recent lucid dream, Konkali found herself standing in front of an old tree that had a door in its trunk. When she opened the door, she saw a coffin, and inside the coffin, she saw herself as an old woman. Konkali asked her older self, "What do you wish that you knew earlier in life or did differently?" Her older self replied, "I wish that I listened more." Then Konkali asked what she would accomplish in life. The answer underwhelmed her. She said something about an administrative job at a university, Konkali told me. I thought, I want to do something cooler than that. And now from the May 4th, 2026 issue of the New Yorker magazine, signed, sealed, delivered, What Happens When Someone Throws a Message into the Sea, by Lauren Collins. Reiko Hiroyama lives on Ishigaki, a subtropical island in Japan. One morning, she went out to comb the beach near her house. Beachcombing conjures up a leisurely world of sand dollars and daiquiris, but Hiroyama's practice was actually about bringing in the trash. Over the years, she had retrieved flip-flops, jerrycans, hairbrushes, toothbrushes, fishing nets, and a seemingly endless array of bottles. Jugs, flasks, milk bottles, beer bottles, water bottles, detergent bottles, baby bottles, motor oil bottles. Yet that day, a turquoise glass bottle caught her eye. Its neck was sticking out of the sand. There was a scroll-like object inside. The sunlight shining on it gave it a strong presence, Hiroyama recalled. It seemed to say, I'm here. The cap was so thoroughly rusted that she couldn't twist it off, so she decided to break the bottle open on a rock. My heart was pounding, she said. She extracted the scroll, a sheet of white paper covered in cursive handwriting. Hiroyama's spirit sank when she realized that the letter was written in French. She put it in a desk drawer, hoping that one day someone would come along who could read it. Hiroyama told me recently, I felt a deep affection for the bottle that had drifted all the way to this island from a distant land. One day, she showed the letter to a German woman who had recently moved to Ishigaki. The woman noticed that the letter contained a man's name, Jean-Paul Sundström, and an address on Île de Ré, an island off the west coast of France. A couple the women knew had vacationed there a few years earlier, and she got in touch with the owner of their Airbnb, who volunteered to find Sundström. No one answered at the address, but a neighbor suggested leaving a note at a nearby hair salon. Contacted by his hairdresser, Sundström called the Airbnb owner, who called the tourist, who called the German woman living on Ishigaki, who walked over to Hiroyama's place. Réal à Une, a newspaper based on Île de Ré, reported that the circle was complete. We can only be amazed and say that many things that we do not think are possible are indeed possible. The article featured a photograph of a smiling Hiroyama standing in front of a banana tree. She was holding Sundström's letter, dated May 8, 2009. My name is Jean-Paul Sundström. I am a sailor aboard a merchant marine vessel traveling from Punta Arenas, Chile, to Yeosu, South Korea. Let us all try together to build a better future and a better world, without war, without poverty, where each of us opens our hearts to others. The miracles of life are more frequent than we think. This is the key that opens the door to hope. 6,500 miles away in rural Utah, two nearly identical letters dated 2011 and 2012 hang in frames on a wall of Clint Buffington's home office. The first was sent on a voyage from Venezuela to Gibraltar, the second between Rotterdam and Montreal. It turns out that Sundström was something of a maritime spammer. Between 1995, when he began working as a cabin boy, and 2020, when he retired as a master pumpman, he sent more than 2,000 bottles into the ocean. He always included some money or cigarettes, and, per maritime tradition, he chunked one into the water for good luck each time he passed through a strait. Buffington told me that both Sundström's bottles were in excellent condition and sealed with some kind of rock-hard caulk or glue-like substance. He found them in 2015 somewhere in the southern region of the Yucayan Archipelago, which encompasses the Bahamas and Turks and Caicos. He won't say more. Buffington is one of the world's most prolific hunters of messages in bottles. Since 2007, when he found his first MIB, as they're known, he has recovered nearly 150 specimens, ranging from love letters to promotional stunts, science projects, pleas for help, and drunken ramblings. "I have been taken prisoner by a grumpy old man," read one letter, written by a son who apparently wasn't having a great time vacationing with his father. Another author confessed, "As we have no more wine on board for the aperitif, we try to pass the time as we can." This writer, too, was French. A man named Frank immortalized his holiday with a woman named Brenda on a sheet of paper from a Princess Cruises notepad. "It's been interesting. It's the end of an 8-year relationship. We are both putting messages in a bottle. Brenda, hope you find what you are looking for. Love, Frank." Buffington's home office recalls a museum exhibition on Mesopotamian material culture crossed with a frat house the morning after a blowout party. There are empty bottles everywhere, crammed onto shelves, catching the light on a windowsill. A bar cart overflows with bottles that Buffington has yet to open, or solve, as he likes to say. "I would describe this place as a chaotic nightmare," Buffington told me cheerfully. He keeps the tools of his trade in a garage workshop that he calls the lab. Buffington's exploits are particularly impressive given that he's the default parent of two young kids and lives in a landlocked state. He is 41 and has a master's degree in English literature. For some years, he did technical writing for a nuclear waste removal company. As his LinkedIn profile notes, he is also a musician playing guitar, harmonica, and mandolin across genres. Basically, he's an earnest and chipper guy, given to recording himself yearningly singing Paul Simon's "Slip Slidin' Away" and to crunching on apples while saying things like, "Cool beans." He is quick to make a friend and maintains relationships with dozens of people whose bottles he's retrieved. He once found a bottle with a note and an 8-year-old piece of wedding cake inside and traced it back to Ed and Carol Myers, a Virginia couple who were celebrating their first anniversary. Buffington himself got married several years later and wrote on Instagram, "So, naturally, Ed and Carol came to our wedding, and it felt like a blessing." A lot of people think of messages in bottles as being sort of flippant or silly or whatever, he told me. My experience has shown me quite the opposite. I don't know exactly what the impulse is, but it's deep, it's fundamental, and it's foundational. I think it's core to being human. The oceanographer Curtis Ebbesmeyer has estimated that 6 million MIBs have been tossed into the ocean since the mid-20th century. Hunting for them combines the suspense of metal detecting with the thrill of opening a present. Even if you're lucky enough to find something, the question remains, will it be any good? Or will you tear open the long-awaited parcel only to discover that it's filled with pornography or cigarette butts? A pen pal writes to someone. The sender of a message in a bottle writes to anyone. The wish, sometimes granted, is that the trajectory of the note is as ineluctable as the tides that carry it, that sucked into currents and pounded by the surf and tossed under rocks and scorched by the sun, the message ends up exactly where it ought to be. I first contacted Buffington in 2016. I had been intrigued by his blog. A message in a bottle can make friends out of strangers, lovers out of the lonely, or give the dead a final chance to speak. I hoped to join him on one of his expeditions, but he was on involuntary hiatus, owing first to the Zika outbreak and then to the COVID pandemic. 8 years later, an email from Buffington popped up in my inbox. "Hi, Lauren, it's been a minute," he wrote, explaining that he was ready to begin far-flung bottle-searching missions again. Months passed as he pored over tide charts, satellite maps, and airline schedules, trying to determine the perfect location for our hunt. Finally, he settled on one. "I really think my iguana is where the magic is going to happen." My iguana, the easternmost island of the Bahamas, is a hatchet-shaped spit of land about 100 nautical miles north of the Windward Passage, the channel separating Cuba from Haiti. The island's name comes from the Lucayans, its original inhabitants. In the early 16th century, Spanish colonization wiped out the local population. The land was sparsely populated until the early 1800s, when settlers arrived from Turks and Caicos. In 1890, the future British statesman Neville Chamberlain visited the island with his brother to see if it would make a good sisal plantation. The latter was in ecstasies over the flamingos, but the Chamberlains ultimately abandoned the project. Mayaguana remains one of the least developed and most difficult to access Bahamian islands. Around 200 people live there. It has no hospital, grocery store, or ATM. Every 10 days, a boat comes to deliver mail and to stock the island's mini-marts. Unlike many trends, the fad for putting messages in bottles can be traced to a specific source. Sure, the Vikings invading Iceland hurled objects overboard and followed the currents toward resources like whales and driftwood. Yes, a 12th century Japanese epic tells of a banished poet who wrote 1,000 verses on slabs of wood called stupas and threw them into the sea, hoping that they would reach his parents. But the modern era of MIBs began in 1833 when the Baltimore Saturday Visitor published M.S. Found in a Bottle, a short story by a fledgling writer named Edgar Allan Poe. The narrator is traveling from the port of Batavia to the Sunda Islands on a ship filled with ghee, opium, and jaggery. As a whirlpool of mountainous and foaming ocean threatens to swallow the ship whole, the narrator attempts to tell the tale of his fateful voyage by sending a manuscript into the ocean. At the last moment, I will enclose the MS in a bottle and cast it within the sea, he vows. As Curtis Ebbesmeyer and Eric Scigliani write in Flotsametrics and the Floating World, the story helped launch a craze for messages in bottles, speaking powerfully to an age obsessed with long-distance communication, from clipper ships and the telegraph to the soon-to-emerge penny post. In 1860, Charles Dickens published his own MIB fiction, A Message from the Sea, about an American captain's discovery of an oilskin-covered, glass-stoppered, strong square case bottle and his attempts to fulfill the charge of the message inside. Whoever finds this is solemnly entreated by the dead to convey it unread to Alfred Raybrock. By the late 1880s, MIBs had gained popularity with naval researchers and amateur oceanographers, including Prince Albert I of Monaco, who launched 1,675 bottles into the North Atlantic. Buffington found his first MIB on a rainy day in Turks and Caicos. I was carrying a piece of styrofoam on my back to shield me, like a turtle, he recalled. The beach was full of empty bottles, but suddenly Buffington snapped to attention, without quite knowing why. I get about 10 feet away and feel this little electric charge, almost like a snake bite, he said. There it was, a cobalt-colored glass bottle with a rubber cork stopper, lying on top of the sand, as though the tide had deposited there, just for him. The message inside, printed on bright orange paper and tied with a piece of string, was written by Larry and Ruth. Canadians traveling to St. Martin aboard a ship. If you get this message, we would greatly appreciate a reply, they wrote, thoughtfully enclosing $2 for postage. Well, there was no going back, Buffington told me. I knew if I could do it once, I could do it again. Collectors hone their interest according to some combination of location and whimsy. A sheller on Sanibel Island amasses Scotch bonnets, while a London mudlark scoots up shards of ancient pottery. A beachcomber was traditionally a deserter or a wayfarer, a vagrant seaman, usually of low character, who loiters about seaports, per the 1913 edition of Webster's Dictionary. Today, beachcombing is a hobby practiced by countless adults and children around the world. People collect shells, coral, sea glass, driftwood, egg cases, fossils, agates, pumice. There is even a subset of beachcombers who scour for sea beans, seeds and fruits carried on ocean currents. Last year's International Sea Bean Symposium, held in Cocoa Beach, Florida, featured a sea bean identification event and a talk called Sea Bean Hoarding, When is Enough Enough? MIBs are distinguished by their air of romance and mystery. The thing about messages in bottles is that there's a person behind the reason this is in the water, Kirsty Scott, the editor of Beachcombing Magazine, told me. There's truly a purpose. Buffington believes that the ocean inspires a certain spiritual expansiveness, unlike freshwater, whose MIBs often contain jokes or pranks. I guarantee you I could go find bottles on the Mississippi. But why would I, he said. On the river, you're thinking downstream thoughts. But on the wide open sea, you're thinking wide open sea thoughts. The Edgar Allan Poe tradition of the MIB in extremis persists. We are torpedoed, one in front and one in back, an unlucky passenger wrote from the Lusitania in 1915. More recently, crew members on an Italian container ship pushed an MIB through a porthole, successfully alerting authorities that they had been hijacked by Somali pirates. Deathbed MIBs have a particular allure as emanations of the soul at its most desperate and thus putatively its most honest. But MIBs are as various as their writers, conveying all manner of existential unburdening. One of the most moving messages Buffington has found acted as a sort of roving memorial to a lost pregnancy. "We'll never forget you, my angel," it read. "Sorry we never got to meet. Love, Mommy." In 1972, the 7-year-old Amor Towles chucked an MIB into the water off Martha's Vineyard, writing that he hoped it would make it to China. Within weeks, he got a reply from an editor at the New York Times. Towles, now a best-selling novelist, credits the encounter with instilling in him a sense that the world is a place where anything can happen. This sensation must have been shared by the person who picked up a bottle one day and discovered inside an original Charles Schulz cartoon sent by the artist on a whim from an Alaskan cruise. The ultimate providential MIB may be a note that a Swedish sailor named Aki Viking stuffed into an empty flask of aqua vitae and threw into the sea in 1955. "To someone beautiful and far away," he wrote, "write to me, whoever you are." He included a photograph of himself along with his home address. The bottle washed ashore in Syracuse, Sicily, where it was found by the father of Paulina Puzo, a 15-year-old girl. 3 years later, Viking and Puzo got married. They were together for more than 40 years. On the final morning of my visit, Buffington and I met on the porch of the hotel to open our bottles. The first, the one that looked like it contained a brochure, was the least promising. Still, Buffington slipped it into a gallon-sized Ziploc to catch any shards. Next, he took a hammer-shaped piece of coral and started tapping the bottle until the body separated from the neck. Buffington extricated the paper. It was surprisingly dry and perfectly legible, but the content was distinctly uninspiring. A user's guide to various lines of lifestyle condoms, including the Rough Rider, seductively studded up and down. The second bottle, with a confetti-ish contents, was equally useless. Whatever had been inside had broken down into a friable mess. Buffington had warned me that the opening process could be unpredictable. "Each bottle creates a sealed environment," he explained. "And once you breach that, everything changes, and it usually changes quickly." With one chance left, he picked up the squarish bottle and held it close to his chest, gingerly screwing off the cap. Then he raised it to his eye like a telescope. "There's definitely paper inside," he said excitedly, "and it has blue lines." Buffington broke the bottle open. Out came a wad of white material that resembled a soggy tissue. Buffington placed it on a binder and tried to separate the paper's furls. Despite his caution, his fiddling provoked several rips. "Well, this would be much better to do in the lab at home," he muttered. "Take it slow, Clinty, take it slow." He got out a Swiss Army knife and began poking at the layers with a blade. The paper was indeed notebook paper bearing handwriting. Letters were beginning to emerge. "RAVA," he called out with the edgy energy of a Wheel of Fortune contestant on the verge of solving a puzzle. "LOV. This was finally, undoubtedly, an MIB. There was no mistaking the trace of a human hand. But much of the paper was impossible to smooth out, and even where it was flat, it was impossible to read. We couldn't discern a single complete word. The message had found us against steep odds, but the meaning was irretrievable. Curtis Ebbesmeyer, the oceanographer, has calculated average reply rates to messages in bottles using data from mass MIB mailings, scientific, evangelical, or promotional campaigns such as the Guinness Drop, or the 40,000 gospel torpedoes that a Tacoma preacher sent out from the Puget Sound in the 1940s. Ebbets Meyer estimates that for every 10 MIBs, one is found and reported. Three are found and ignored. Three wash up but are never found. One gets buried in the sand. One drifts for years and years, and one suffers any of a number of other fates, including getting swallowed by an animal or sunk by the weight of barnacles. I was waiting at the airport when the plane came on Friday afternoon. Buffington, who was initially supposed to leave with me, had decided to extend his trip. "I'll walk over coals, man," he told me of his commitment to finding a bottle. After I left, he kayaked to even more remote points on the island. But these two proved fruitless. Finally, he drove to the spot where we had looked on the first day. "It was the very last place I could go," he said. He walked until he saw our footprints and then pushed a little farther. About a half mile on, he spotted a champagne bottle, green and clear, with a perfect little cigarette of a scroll inside. The real thing, at last. A couple of weeks later, Buffington held the bottle close to his computer camera, turning it slowly for me to admire. He pointed out that whoever had written it had sealed the scroll with a Band-Aid. "The really exciting thing is you can see writing in there," Buffington said. He was right. Even at a distance, I could make out at least one full sentence written in what looked like Sharpie. "Thanks for finding me." "That's as legit as it gets," Buffington exclaimed. The bottle had a screw cap, and Buffington's plan was to pry it off and dump the message out as if pouring a drink. He gripped the cap and gave it a firm twist. I could hear a hissing sound, years worth of air pressure being released. "This is nuts," Buffington said. "I don't think I even need any tools." The message slid right out. As Buffington unwound the scroll, his hands began to shake. "Thanks for finding me," he read aloud. "I was in WV and traveled to the Frying Pan Lighthouse, where a desperate lady wanted to say there is life during a pandemic. And I hope we survive the 2020 election. God bless you, J.A.V. The message was dated September 20, 2020. The sender hadn't included contact information or a full name. I wasn't even sure that the first initial in J.A.V. was J and not L. "Let's not be discouraged," Buffington said. "We have lots of clues. We'll find them." The first move, obviously, was to Google Frying Pan Lighthouse, which turned out to be a decommissioned Coast Guard lighthouse located near the end of the Frying Pan Shoals in North Carolina. The tower was intended to help ships navigate the shoals, part of a perilous stretch of shallow water known as the Graveyard of the Atlantic. Built in 1964, the tower looks like an oil rig topped with a Tuscan campanile. Frying Pan Tower, as it is often called, had an impressive online presence, including a Facebook account with more than 300,000 followers. A man named Richard Neal, a former Oklahoma software engineer, bought the tower in a government auction for $85,000 in 2010 and turned it into a nonprofit environmental research center. Adventurous souls can sleep on-site and volunteer for restoration projects. In addition to enjoying such activities as golfing off the lighthouse's platform with biodegradable balls made from fish food. Buffington recorded a video and posted it to social media. "If you know anyone who's ever been to Frying Pan Tower and you can share this with them, that would be awesome," he announced, brandishing the letter. In March, Joyce Van Gilder was pulling into a building site when she got a text from her sister-in-law. It was a screenshot showing Buffington with the message from my iguana. "I just kept looking at it," Van Gilder recalled. "I was like, that definitely is my handwriting, but I have no memory of this." Van Gilder admitted that the evidence that she had written the letter was overwhelming. She lives in Charleston, West Virginia, where she works in architectural services. Her middle name is Anne. Her sister-in-law, Vanessa, is a lighthouse fanatic. And in 2020, in the waning days of summer, the women had driven from West Virginia to visit Frying Pan Tower. It was the middle of the pandemic, and the two were eager to get out in nature and do some manual labor. They spent 3 days repainting a pantry and clearing out expired foods. Evenings were festive. Vanessa had packed a kite to fly from the tower. Van Gilder had brought a bottle of André Spumante. "My go-to," she explained, "cheap, sparkling wine." One night after dinner, Van Gilder decided to write a note. It was all coming back to her now. She had an empty bottle. She was, not unrelatedly, a little tipsy. She was on a decommissioned lighthouse in the middle of the ocean, and she and her boyfriend had recently been watching Survivor, in which people were finding these little messages all around different places on the islands. On a whim, she jotted down a few sentences. The desperate lady was Van Gilder herself. "I had my mother staying with me during the pandemic," she recalled. "She's now 90 years old, and we have learned that we cannot live together. Bottle solved." Confronted with her handiwork 6 years later, after a journey that likely took it into the Gulf Stream and around the entire clockwise circuit of the North Atlantic, a trip of several thousand punishing miles, Van Gilder seemed more concerned about the bottle than about the message. "I feel like an international litter bug," she admitted. Buffington had shown her a photograph of the site where the bottle was found. "When I saw all the stuff that was sitting around where he picked it up, I was like, man, I guess I need to get down there and clean up some trash," she said. Van Gilder had sent the bottle with casual intentions, but I was oddly moved by receiving it. "I grew up in Wilmington, not far from the frying pan, and in 1988, my father had a bad accident on Bald Head, the nearest point of land. As I read about the tower, the names of local TV affiliates and the daily newspaper from my childhood kept cropping up. For almost a decade, I had been writing a book about Wilmington. Physically, I was in France, but my head was in my hometown. Somehow it seemed it had written me back." This article was edited for length. And now, from the March 26, 2026 online edition of The New Yorker, how the Trump administration has turned left-wing activism into terrorism. The trial of supposed Antifa members after a shooting at an ICE facility is part of a disturbing strategy. By Rachel Monroe. On the evening of July 4, 2025, around a dozen people arrived at the ICE Prairie Land Detention Facility in Alvarado, Texas, nearly 30 miles south of Fort Worth, for an event that they would later characterize as a noise demonstration. They wore black and brought with them Roman candles, first aid kits, bubbles, a bullhorn, and a flag that read, "Resist Fascism, Fight Oligarchy." A few of them also brought body armor and firearms. From a distance of at least 50 yards, the group launched fireworks into the air and relayed messages of encouragement in Spanish through the bullhorn. A young man, whom no one in the group had met before, brought spray paint. Someone wrote, "F you pigs," on a guard shack. Someone else slashed the tires of an ICE van. Two unarmed guards emerged from the facility and told the protesters to leave. The next few seconds were chaotic and confusing. An officer of the Alvarado Police Department drove up, got out of his car, and drew his weapon. One of the protesters, a then 32-year-old named Benjamin Song, shouted, "Get to the rifles!" and then he fired his AR-15-style weapon. The officer, who was struck near his collarbone, returned fire. Song's gun jammed. It may have been hit by one of the officer's bullets, and he ran. Most of the protesters were arrested soon afterward. Song was apprehended 11 days later. Initially, Song and others who were at Prairie Land that night were charged with attempted murder. Then, on September 10th, the conservative activist Charlie Kirk was killed at an outdoor event at a college in Utah. President Donald Trump blamed the assassination on the radical left and vowed a crackdown. For years, Republicans had used the term Antifa as a catch-all for left-wing activists. In the days after Kirk's death, Trump issued an executive order declaring Antifa a domestic terror organization and a presidential memorandum directing federal resources to investigate and disrupt financial networks that fund left-wing domestic terrorism. During a roundtable on Antifa, which featured a mixture of conservative influencers and government officials, then Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem called Antifa just as dangerous as Hamas, Hezbollah, and ISIS. In November, prosecutors released a new indictment that referred to the Prairie Land defendants as operatives in a North Texas Antifa cell and added the charge of material support to terrorists. The Prairie Land case was billed as the federal government's first indictment of a purported Antifa cell. Earlier this month, nine defendants were found guilty of various charges, eight of them for providing material support for terrorism. Song was also convicted of attempted murder. Today's verdict on terrorism charges will not be the last as the Trump administration systematically dismantles Antifa and finally halts their violence on America's streets, Attorney General Pam Bondi said of the conviction. The three-week federal trial of the nine Prairie Land defendants took place in a Fort Worth courtroom that had the ambience of a mid-century steakhouse. In the aftermath of the shooting, law enforcement officers searched the defendants' cars, apartments, and a brick home, affectionately nicknamed the Big Gay House, where some of them lived. They seized more guns, body armor, and a printing press. They took pictures of a hoodie that said Chingla Migra, stickers that read, Be Gay, Do Crime, and a drawing of President Trump with a swastika. They looked into Emma Goldman Book Club, an anarchist reading group that several of the defendants belonged to. They collected publications with titles such as Organizing for Attack, Insurrectionary Anarchy, Visualize Industrial Collapse, and a zine titled The Satanic Death Cult is Real, which offers a feminist analysis of horror movies. Law enforcement pulled over Daniel Sanchez Estrada, Rueda's husband, who was not at Prairie Land that night, on the suspicion that he had removed a box of explosives from her home. The box turned out to be full of more zines and an old love letter. Sanchez Estrada was charged with conspiracy and hiding evidence. He, too, was found guilty. Although none of the publications were illegal, nor were the guns, the defense attorneys noted, the government argued that the evidence pointed to a shared ideology. In Assistant U.S. Attorney Sean Smith's closing statement, he said that the defendants should and could have known that Song would shoot a police officer because of Antifa. Unlike other groups designated as terrorist threats, Antifa is more of a set of tactics and a political philosophy than a discernible group. Broadly speaking, it refers to a form of militant anti-fascism that embraces direct action, confrontations with right-wing protesters, say, or infrastructure sabotage. But the Trump administration has embraced a more capacious definition. In the presidential memorandum, Trump characterized the common threads of anti-fascism as anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, and anti-Christianity, support of the overthrow of the United States government, extremism on migration, race, and gender, and hostility toward those who hold traditional American views on family, religion, and morality. Some cooperating witnesses, who pleaded guilty in exchange for lighter sentences, were asked by prosecutors to identify defendants who were aligned with Antifa. But when questioned by defense attorneys, they described their and their friends' political beliefs using a range of labels: libertarian, socialist, communist, anarchist, and anti-authoritarian. The government attempted to reconcile the hodgepodge of leftist ideologies and micro-factions through the testimony of Kyle Scheidler, a director and senior analyst at the Center for Security Policy, a far right-wing think tank. Scheidler, who has put himself forward as an expert in radical Islam and black identity extremism, is also focused on Antifa. Shortly after Kirk's assassination, he published a roadmap for the Trump administration detailing how to dismantle far-left extremist networks, targeting progressive nonprofits that may provide funding for leftist organizations and revoking visas for people who demonstrate support for anarchist or Marxist groups. According to the roadmap, environmental or abortion rights groups are also potentially suspect, since they may be used as a recruiting tool to activate individuals and bring them further into a movement whose true objective is revolution. Scheidler is a regular guest on right-wing podcasts and cable television programs, but this was his first time testifying as an expert in court. In his testimony, he purported to pinpoint various hallmarks of Antifa in the defendant's behavior, including using Signal, wearing black block, and crowdfunding. Later, I spoke with Tom Brzozowski, a former counsel for domestic terrorism at the Department of Justice's National Security Division, who told me that the vague language around Antifa, both in this case and in federal filings, was troubling. There's no way to discern whether you know the activity that you're engaged in might somehow be construed by the government as Antifa or Antifa-aligned, he said. The dude dressed in black mixing up with an ICE officer physically, that's a problem. You can't assault ICE officers. But then you got the guy who's at the same protest and was not assaulting anybody. Say they both went to the same training session that was put on 2 days before, about how to peacefully protest at ICE facilities, and how to know your constitutional rights. And that training was funded by a philanthropic organization that's interested in promoting civil liberties. That entire stream is now under active investigation. That's Antifa aligned for you. The arrests, prosecutions, and cooperating agreements have had a devastating effect on an already small and embattled North Texas activist community. A support committee member in glasses and a hoodie named Luis said that he'd taken the day off work to stand with the defendants, some of whom were his friends. In the days after the July 4th incident, law enforcement officials had characterized the shooting as a planned ambush designed to draw ICE personnel outside, an elaborately coordinated plot rather than the reactive and volatile eruption that it seems to have been. There's a lot of fantasy circulating in our society, and one of the fantasies is exactly this: people making a violent confrontation with ICE in an organized way, he said. We who were close to the situation were like, we know these people. This is off. I don't know what happened, but it's not what they're describing. Luis sighed when I mentioned the guns. Some of the defendants had been members of the Socialist Rifle Association, a leftist gun group, and held gun range outings. Song, a former Marine reservist, hosted tactical training sessions. The prosecution emphasized the fact that Song's rifle had a binary trigger, which allowed it to fire twice as quickly, a modification that is typically legal in Texas. Lawyers for the government also brought up the fact that in response to a text requesting a political donation, a defendant had replied, "As a leftist in Texas, my advice is to buy a gun and learn how to use it. Things are looking grim." I'm not a gun person, Louis said, but Texas is a gun culture place. People have guns as a hobby, as a social thing. And there is a history in this town of open carry of long rifles. In the 2010s, Tarrant County, which comprises Fort Worth, was the hub of the right-wing open carry movement. Groups of pro-gun protesters would parade around suburban coffee shops and big box stores with their rifles displayed. More recently, armed counter-protesters were a visible presence at drag performances and Black Lives Matter demonstrations. Soon, armed left-wing counter-protesters started showing up, too. In 2020, an armed Black Lives Matter advocate named Garrett Foster was fatally shot by an Uber driver who claimed that Foster was going to aim his gun at him. The driver was found guilty of murder, but was pardoned by Governor Greg Abbott. Some of the Prairie Land defendants reportedly eschewed guns. "I'm a gun owner, and she's never approved of that," Lowry told me of her sister, Savannah Batten. "She had a pair of maracas. They are using her first aid kit that she carries with her everywhere as evidence proving material support for terrorism." I'm like, what? In the courtroom, Scheidler's long-winded testimony seemed at times to frustrate even Judge Pittman. "Just answer the question," Pittman told him after a particularly testy exchange. "You don't need to spar so much." After Scheidler was cross-examined, the feeling in the park outside was briefly gleeful. "Oh, my God, it was amazing," Gabrielle Coza, the mother-in-law of a defendant named Autumn Hill, said. "His whole testimony was a tautology." Some supporters were hopeful that the Trump administration's indiscriminate use of the word terrorist, for instance, when describing Renee Good, Alex Pretty, and Miramar Martinez, might cause even a jury of Texans to question the government's case. But the prevailing mood on most days was low-key dread. Some of the defendants, including Hill, are trans women, and Smith, the prosecutor, was either careless or strategic in his repeated use of masculine pronouns and names. One afternoon, I watched as Lydia Coza, Hill's wife, who is also a trans woman, listened to a prosecutor read posts from the Emma Goldman Book Club's X account as she folded and unfolded a cough drop wrapper with her long, nervous fingers. Gabrielle Coza, who had flown in from Arizona for the trial, put a thin arm around her daughter. When Pittman announced a 15-minute break, they both stood. "What's the crime?" Lydia said to no one in particular. "What's the crime?" The prosecution delivered its closing arguments in front of a stack of firearms and boxes of radical literature. "What's at issue here is using legal things to do illegal things," Smith said. The defense characterized the case in starker terms. "They want you to put protesters in prison as terrorists," Blake Burns, the attorney for a defendant named Elizabeth Soto, told the jury. "That's not something that's happened before, And you are literally the only people on earth that can stop that from happening. The jury took about 2 days to declare the defendants guilty of many of the charges against them. Five were charged with attempted murder, but only Song was convicted. Song faces a sentence of between 20 years to life in prison. Seven others, including Hill, Batten, Ueda, and Soto, face between 10 and 60 years. Sanchez Estrada faces up to 40 years. Pittman will oversee their sentencing in June. Some of the defendants also face state charges. After the verdicts were read, the defendants were driven back to jail. Their friends, family members, and supporters watched them go. Lydia Cosa was wearing her blue patterned wedding dress. "We love you. We see you. We would like to free you," the crowd chanted. I'll end with a poem. From the April 27, 2026 issue of The New Yorker, Favor by Franz Wright. My death is in the second drawer. While you're standing there, would you mind getting me one? And there should be a couple left in the medicine cabinet when I wake up. If I wake up. If I wake up tomorrow. But I am confused. I thought today was tomorrow. If I wake up in a second on the right side of the mirror. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website again is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. We'd love to hear from you. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.